I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the more interesting books of last year was the HBC Brigades, Culture, Conflict, and Perilous Journeys of the Fur Trade. Its author, Nancy Marguerite Anderson, joins me now to talk about the book, which is a lively recounting of the thousand-mile trails encountered by the brigades of the Hudson's Bay Company. They would travel over mountains and through river crossings to reach isolated fur trading posts. Miss Anderson writes of the size of these brigades and the challenges they would encounter amongst themselves and naturally along the way. And Nancy's book illustrates how formative these trails are to the shaping of the British Columbia we know today. As a lot of the highways or roads we know now follow a lot of these paths. Nancy Anderson is Métis and an accepted member of Métis Nation British Columbia. She is, as we'll hear in the interview, descended from a Northwest Company voyageur. Visit her website at nancymarguerite.anderson.com for more. This book is published by Ronsdale Press. We spoke in late December 2024. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Nancy Marguerite Anderson. Ms. Anderson, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. This book is just a fascinating, you obviously tell us, you're a marvelous storyteller, a great historian. It also seems like it was a lot of fun to write, was it?
Yes, it was. It was, because I'm following, part of the story is that I'm following my ancestors around the territory.
Mm.
I got interested in the brigades when I wrote my first book, which was a biography of my great-grandfather, and he was heavily involved in the brigades and the explorations, and so this is a deeper look at his part in that. In that part of history,
and skip to the end of the book where you talk about having eight generations of Métis people in your family, and you know we think of the Métis as you know from that part and you know in the middle of the country in Manitoba.
They all come through Red River or that part of the world, but we had eight generations on this side of the mountains.
Yeah, and so
and
that,
lots of people have.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful thing to think about in terms of that you feel at home in BC, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is where I live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Victoria specifically is where I live. I've lived in other places in BC and Toronto and England and places like that, but I come home to here.
And so in Victoria, you know, that's the home of the BC Archives.
Yes.
I guess that was geographically easy for you to access a lot of these documents that you use in the writing of the book, right?
Yes. Many of A.C. Anderson's documents or manuscripts that he wrote while he was working in the fur trade and after are in the archives. That's exactly where they are.
Yeah, and where are the HBC archives, by the way?
Winnipeg. They're part of the Museum of Manitoba.
I see, yeah.
Or the Manitoba Archives. I'm not too sure which.
Yeah. And so how have you found it in terms of accessing the documents? I mean, there are sources that you use in the book that haven't been used heretofore. What is it like when you're mining the archives, if you will, online and physically and finding this stuff? I mean, it must be exciting.
I find the most amazing stuff sometimes that I never knew existed, and it's just by accident. But BC Archives, I went into the archives first of all in about 1980 because I owned a business that got very hot in the daytime. It was a bakery, and it was exposed to the sun for hours. So the summer was just killed me. And I went down there because it was air-conditioned, and it was open 8 hours a day every weekend. So and at that time you had to take a pencil and paper down, and you could only use a pencil, and you had to request the documents ahead of time and handwrite them out with pencil. So I did that for ages all summer just so I got some cool. And I call myself an accidental historian, and that's why I learned all about A.C. Anderson's documents and what he said. And then I put it away for a few years because because I was busy.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, I came back to it and looked at it, and I had nothing to do. And I said, I have a book here. And so I put it together and got the other documents that I needed for his biography and put it all together, and that was my first book. So,
And what is it like, Nancy, when you read someone's account or someone's journal in an archive, say? It must be very interesting to read, to say the least. But, I mean, in terms of the reliability as a historian, as someone who's writing about it many years later, how do you find their accounts, say? Are they, in fact, as reliable as they seem?
Not necessarily, but... Everyone has their own point of view. But when you're talking about, and I work mostly from journals
mm-hmm.
that are voyages, because that's what A.C. Anderson's journals are in there. A lot of his, there's lots of things that you can't tell from his life, but there's information in his manuscripts that can go into the book. Other people, I didn't look too much at other people's journals because I was writing about A.C. Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
But on occasion, I found things that were, quite often I found people talking about him as if he was different from them. And that was became the theme of the book, is how was A.C. Anderson different from all the other fur traders and the other people, the colonists and all of that surrounded him.
And how were you able to relate to Anderson? I mean, he's obviously an ancestor, but, you know, he's far removed from you, you know, physically and time-wise. Are you able to discern whether you like him or not, say?
When I was writing his biography, I was so passionately in love with the man.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. So, yeah, I was able to like him. I was able to figure out the good things about him. I also connected with other family members, some of whom were in England, that could tell me about his childhood and growing up in India and all of this. So I had a tremendous amount of information about him that no one else had or had put together. I was passionately in love with A.C. Anderson when I was writing his biography.
And is that something that started early on in the process of writing, or is that something that you developed over time, say?
I think it started fairly soon. I don't know how passionate I was immediately, but when I got his story together, I respected him so much, and I liked him so much. And I could relate to him because just being Métis, I have some of the same experiences that he had. I also traveled extensively through British Columbia. And so I drove around and went over all his brigade trails and things. And the other thing is, when I was a child, and I only realized it after, when I was a child, my uncle took us on trips all over BC to all the places that he had been and over all of the brigade trails. And I didn't know why. It was only later that I put that together. I also inherited, he did a lot of research too, and I also inherited all his papers. And I inherited the family Bible, and I inherited A.C. Anderson's chess sets and all sorts of things.
Yeah, that's fascinating to think about how you know that you come to write that first book, and then now this new one, the HBC Brigades. When you talk about a brigade, what makes up a brigade, say, in terms of its size? Like, you know, how many people are we talking about traveling here at one time?
The 1848 Brigade, which was the first one to come out, had something like 400 horses in it. But they came from Fort St. James, they came from Fort Colville, which is near Spokane, and they came from Kamloops. And then you have the young horses, causing chaos, mm-hmm. the mares, mm-hmm. you know. So you have this great mess of horses, and then they would, they had 60 or 80 horses in later years in mm-hmm. the brigades, in the New Caledonia brigades, and then Kamloops had a batch of horses, and then Fort Colville had horses, 50 to 80 horses, I think. So there were a lot of horses. They had trouble keeping them in good health.
Yeah, I'll bet, yeah. And so in terms of people, I mean, how many people, let's say you're traveling you're traveling on horses and along with horses. Not all the horses are being used, say, for carrying stuff or people at one time, right?
Sometimes they are. There was one year when the voyageurs, the employees, the men had to walk from Fort Langley or Fort Hope to Kamloops because there weren't enough horses for them to ride.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell, but the areas around the forts just basically emptied out. Everyone went onto the brigade. Fort Colville in later years hired indigenous people to work in the brigades because there weren't enough white men or Métis
yeah.
there. There were First Nations in a lot of the brigades. Chief William of Williams Lake worked in the brigades. Silahaxitza, who is Chilahitza now, he worked in the brigades and Black Eye Sun, and so a lot of First Nations. So it's really hard to tell.
Yeah. Well, what?
But quite a few.
Yeah. Well, so the other thing that I was wondering about, even before I started the book, was, and I learned this as I'm reading the book that you know the horses carry stuff, you know, as well as someone who's riding a horse.
Yes.
The trails were such that you couldn't have, say, a wagon. Pulling it, right? A horse pulling a wagon, right? Yeah.
Although James Douglas always wanted to have wagons from Fort Langley or from Fort Hope over the Coquihalla rather than horses. He wanted a wagon road. If you can imagine putting a wagon road over that, over the Tuolumne Plateau, good luck!
Yeah, see, that's the other thing that you illustrate so wonderfully is just the geography of the place then as now. Which makes it impossible for a lot of things that we would think would be, say, a natural way of transporting something or goods or so on. The terrain is such that you just can't do that. And then you're also beholden to the weather, and we know what that's like in this province throughout the year, right?
Yes. Although it tended to be hot and sunny in the interior rather than rainy. It was rainy on the coast.
Mm.
But Williams Lake gets pretty hot and dry, and so does the Okanagan. So there was more sun and heat than there was rain. They did have rainfalls. And in one year, Donald McLean came out in 1858. He came out over the Brigade Trail from Kamloops to Fort Langley to Fort Hope for his second load of goods. And on his return, he got caught in the snowstorm, and many of his horses died.
Mm.
And don't ask me what happened to the packs, because if you have no horses, you can't get the packs in.
Yeah.
So that's 100 packs sitting out on the mountain somewhere with horses that are dead.
Yeah.
And, he survived. He survived. He made it home, but many of his products didn't.
What are we talking about in terms of these goods and these products? I mean, these are the furs as well as other things, right?
Yeah. When they're coming south to Fort Victoria or to Fort Langley, they are bringing out the furs, and all the furs have to come out. You couldn't leave a few behind at the fort. They all had to come out. They also brought out castoreum. And they brought out passengers, although they tried to discourage that as much as possible. Do you know what castoreum is?
No. Let's tell people listening just what that is.
Yep. Beaver and many other animals have two little sacks of fluid next to their tail, next to their anus. And they use that to mark their territory. They'll lick it or spread it or something, and it marks their territory. So that's a valuable oil, and it was used, it's used in perfumes. It's used today in perfumes and in medicines. And so when they get a beaver in, they get the little, I can't remember what the sacs are called, but they collect them and dry them and put them in a package of some sort and haul them out. And it was very valuable. It was a part of their business.
Yeah, it's incredible to think about, you know, something so small like that and how it adds up and how valuable it is for people elsewhere.
Now, when they were going in, they carried tobacco, 90-pound rolls of tobacco. They carried carrots of tobacco, which are large carrot-shaped, tied-up tobacco. They carried axes and metal goods and things that they would use building their fort or whatever, that the stuff from the blacksmith shop, if there was no blacksmith shop, they would carry iron to make these things. They carried provisions, like a 100-pound pack of fresh beef and things like that. They carried all the trading goods, so beads, blankets, tons of trading goods, anything for the trade for the interior folks. They carried clothing. They carried, they may have at some times carried deer hides for leather. They carried everything that was needed for trade in the interior forts. They carried in their trade goods to, say, Fort St. James. They carried out their furs that they had traded the trade goods for. And so there were some years they didn't get enough products in, and that affected their trades the next year.
Well, what was it like for these members of the brigade, say, and you mentioned a moment ago, you know, there were a number of First Nations people who get involved in that. Their day must be, you know, tiring and, you know, having to travel a lot and carry a lot and go through a lot of you know, a varied array of terrain, say. What were their days like, and not just the working day, but the I mean, those are probably long hours that they have to travel. What are what's their downtime like?
The brigades would start, the horse part of the brigades would start early in the morning. So at dawn, more or less, when the men got up and they rounded up the horses and packed and loaded them and all of that. And the gentlemen just sat by the fire and waited for it to be done and worried. And everyone was anxious to be better than everyone else, to be faster.
Sure.
And so they would start off, the horses finally, probably at about 9 o'clock. They'd ride maybe 20 hours, take a three or four hour break to rest the horses, and then they would ride on to the next campsite. So they'd cover about 30 miles a day through the Okanagan, say. And but it also depended on where good campsites were. They might have a shorter day if there was, they had to have feed and water for the horses at each campsite. If there was no feed and water, they went on further or they stopped earlier.
Yeah. And you highlight in the book, you know, when a group of people have to travel, say, together, you know, there are obviously tensions and conflict. By the way, when they would travel, say, you know, was there, in terms of, say, threats to them, people stealing stuff or I don't know what the word would be, the version of a pirate,
stealing,
say.
Stealing is what the fur traders called it. So, yes, you would have First Nations people following the brigade, and sometimes horses would wander off and go missing. And, mm-hmm. and James Douglas, for example, went off and hunted down the thieves, and some friendly First Nations people caught the thieves or caught the horses and brought them back. And yes, there was theft. On one occasion, at Tulameen, at their camp near Tulameen, the local First Nations people rustled all the Hudson's Bay Company horses, drove them off from the camp, mm-hmm. and the Hudson's Bay gentlemen followed them and found the chiefs and gave them a little lecture on whether or not they were going to get trade goods ever again, and they had their horses yeah. returned. So that, as far as I know, that happened only once, but there were quite a few horse thefts as the brigades were traveling out. And also theft of product when you were portaging over in the boats downriver, portaging over a point of land and carrying the boats across. They had guards at both ends of the portage.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, at the heart of the book is the reader reads about, say, a group of people forcing change on another group of people and the ways they go about it, the results, and you know, there's obviously consequences to all of this. What have you found in terms of, say, the relationship between, because you're dealing with different groups of people here, you know, you have the Métis, you have the First Nations, you have the Canadiens, the British, at one point near the Americans are involved as well, coming up here. How did they all get along? And I think that'll surprise some people. There are conflicts and very, very dramatic and deadly ones throughout the story here, but for the most part, they managed to work. You know, there was cooperation, wasn't there?
Yes, there was, very much so. I found that the First Nations around the Lower Fraser River, around Yale and Spuzzlum and that Kikaloose, which is where the Alexandra Bridge is, mm-hmm. They actually had no real interest in the fur trade. They were far from any fur trade fort, but they knew who the Hudson's Bay Company men, and they knew who they were, and they quite willingly went out and chopped down trees and built the trail up to the top of the mountain. And in the next year, when the brigades actually came through, they would go out and they would find the packs and bring them back. And although Donald Manson suspected that there was some theft, they may not have been.
Mm.
So they actually worked on the brigade trails as much as some of the brigadiers did.
Yeah.
And when A.C. Anderson made his explorations through Anderson and Seton Lake and then back up the Fraser Canyon, he found that the First Nations people offered him food. They'd lay out their food, and then more than they could carry, more mm-hmm. than the fur traders could carry. And then there was quite a scramble when the Hudson's Bay Company men passed by without taking the food, and everybody else, the First Nations, rushed out to claim as much food as they could. So it was interesting, but the First Nations men everywhere, or the people everywhere, knew who the Hudson's Bay Company men were, even if they lived nowhere near a fur trade fort, because they traveled all around their community. They went to the fishing places that the Hudson's Bay Company also visited. And they probably, before Fort Langley was built, the explorers of the Lower Fraser River discovered that the First Nation, the Stolo people that lived on the Fraser River, actually had traveled regularly to Kamloops. They wore some of the clothing that was sold in the Kamloops store.
Mm.
So it was pretty amazing how much they just walked around their territory, or they rode. Mm. The Lower Fraser, the Solo, didn't have horses. Mm. So they would just hike to where they wanted to go.
And you know, listen to you now, you realize just how these trails shape a lot of these transportation corridors that we use today, don't they? And create a lot of the country and the province that would become British Columbia.
Yes, people are driving over the Brigade trails all the time.
Yeah,
as they go through the Similkameen Valley, mm-hmm. that's the Brigade Trail, almost exactly. Up the west side of the Okanagan Lake, that's the Brigade Trail.
You must be asked, Nancy, about why we should know this stuff. There's obviously a lot of controversy about the fur trade and the relationship between, say, the HBC or the Northwest Company with the First Nations, you know, and how that resonates to today. But you know, as we've listened to you and for those of us who've read parts of the book, there's obviously a necessity to know this stuff, isn't there?
I think so. I have run across people who know almost nothing about the 50 years of fur trade history before the gold miners. Mm. A lot of people think of the gold rush as being the beginning of British Columbia, and it wasn't. John Stewart was here and built the first Brigade trails in about 1811 or 1813. Yeah. I mean, that's when Brigade trail history began. And there were trails all over British Columbia. The highways, half of the highways follow the Brigade trails.
Yeah. This time that you cover between, say, 1820 and the late 50s, 1850s, that's a time that we need to think about. Yeah, because there is this bias towards the gold rush, towards the railroad even, that's where history began. But, there's obviously this chunk of history that you've covered so well. I so enjoyed talking to you today, Nancy. I appreciate your time, and congratulations and continued good luck with the book. Thanks for this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it too.
The website for more is at nancymarguerite.anderson.com. The book is called The HBC Brigades, Culture, Conflict, and Perilous Journeys of the Fur Trade. It's published by Ronsdale Press. Its author, Nancy Marguerite Anderson, joined me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.